In this unit, we want to direct our attention to the issue of God and evil, particularly as understood in the thought of Thomas Aquinas. In other words, what does Thomas Aquinas have to say that will help us in understanding God and evil? In the previous lecture, we dealt with evil as a quote-unquote problem and gave a reply that attempted to demonstrate that this problem does not compromise, one, the existence of God, and two, his metaphysical attributes, namely his omnibenevolency and his omnipotence. The suggestion that I made in the previous part or previous lecture, or at least hinted at, the question of what if we could incorporate a more robust theology or more theology into our understanding of this problem in order to get a better understanding of God and his creation. If that were the case, would we gain a better perspective, a better understanding of the issue regarding God and evil? And I think that indeed is the case. And I'm indebted to the work of Brian Davies. His recent book came out in 2011 called Thomas Aquinas on God and Evil. And he had written a previous book, 2006, on the reality of God and the problem of evil. Brian Davies is a Thomistic scholar. And very few Thomistic scholars have even dealt with the notion of Aquinas' view concerning God and evil, and we'll discuss why that is in just a little bit. But these two books I find quite enlightening on this issue, and I think that you'll find a number of his points to be worth considering in more detail. I'll be sketching out a brief outline of some of the major things that he says, and along the way we'll be dealing with probably some technical terminology. If you're not familiar with Thomistic studies, we'll try to introduce you to those terms. We also will revisit some of those terms when we deal with the issue of metaphysics and epistemology. So our single objective here is to appreciate the contribution of Thomas Aquinas to the understanding of God and evil. I'm not interested in convincing you to become a Thomist in all respects, but I do think that this great thinker of the Christian Church does have a lot to say, particularly on the issue of God and evil, and much that we can at least learn from, and perhaps even at some points be able to incorporate what he has to say into our discussions regarding God and evil, and even in dealing with our apologetics concerning God and evil. So our outline looks like this. We'll deal with a slide in each of these categories and deal with issues related to the topic of God and evil. First, we'll deal with modern philosophy and the problem of evil. Then we'll look at, does evil mean that God does not exist? A very important question that Aquinas did directly address. We'll deal with what is there, or what is creation. Then we'll look at what is good and bad. Then we'll address God's nature directly. Then we'll look particularly at God's perfections, mainly his goodness. And then we'll deal with the creator and evil, and then deal with some further observations related to this issue concerning God and evil. So let's first deal with the issue of modern philosophy and the so-called problem of evil. You're probably familiar, I've quoted him before, with David Hume, who put it more succinctly than just about any other modern philosopher when he says, "Is he, God, willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is impotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Whence then is evil?" And perhaps J.L. Mackey would be the best to cite as a modern scholar with respect to this issue and this problem. He says, in its simplest form, the problem is this. God is omnipotent. God is wholly good, yet evil exists. There seems to be some contradiction between these three propositions. The theologian, it seems, at once must adhere and cannot consistently adhere to all three. And it's also important to point out that the theist, or even the apologist, Christian apologist, response is usually to assume, along with the critic or the skeptic, that there exists a quote-unquote problem between God and evil. And I'd like to back up, and I think it's worth doing, to ask a prior question to all of that. And that prior question is this: what is their concept of God? It doesn't matter whether we're dealing with the critic like David Hume or G.L. Mackey, or pick any theist that responds to it. I think it's worth asking, what is your concept of God? And if you look at a lot of books on the problem of evil, I think that you'll note that very, very few of them deal with the concept of God or deal with theology proper as a science in exploring who God is and what creation is. A critic or a skeptic or a theist in dealing with this issue, I think it's something that they have missed. There isn't really a serious exploration with regards to the very nature of God and what creation or reality is itself. And I'd like to suggest that both the theist and the atheist likely does not have the same concept of God that you would find expressed in a classical theology, a robust classical theology that you would find in someone like Thomas Aquinas. The modern assumption is that there's a problem, and it does not adequately take into account the nature of God. One of the assumptions today among theists as well as atheists is that God is in a category of needing moral justification because of evil. But what if that's not the case? What if the modern conception of God by the skeptic, atheist, as well as the theist is wrong or inadequate in some way? And what if the classical view of God, as expressed by Thomas Aquinas, shows that a more correct or adequate view of God reveals that there really is no problem? Perhaps that's a bit too ambitious. But what if it's not as big of a problem as we first thought? And even if we can't still answer everything with regards to God and evil, what if we see that this approach points us in a more correct or right direction? And perhaps it would show us that the problem is really for us as human beings with respect to evil more than it is for God. Let's turn to one of the direct questions that Thomas Aquinas does address. And this is worth pointing out because Aquinas never really offers a standalone treatise on what modern philosophers, contemporary philosophers, would call the problem of evil. Aquinas, of course, offers much on the topic of God and evil, but one of the difficulties and troubles that I hinted at earlier is the fact that it's found throughout, scattered throughout his entire corpus of writings, which is quite large, and it needs to be brought together if one is to really understand his position with regards to God and evil, and particularly what he might have to say about the so-called problem of evil that modern philosophy addresses today. Aquinas was a Dominican friar, and the Summa Theologica was written not to provide a philosophy textbook. Aquinas held a chair in theology, not a chair in philosophy. So his profession was to teach, to instruct Dominican priests in theology. And his Summa Theologica was written to provide a better alternative to the theology books and manuals that were being used in his day in order to teach and instruct Dominican priests in order to prepare for the priesthood. And again, it's throughout this work and his other works that we find the issue of God and evil being dealt with. And it really takes a Thomistic scholar such as Brian Davies to really bring this together and to put it into a concentrated form and lay it out for us. And that's exactly what he has done in his works. But Thomas Aquinas does deal with this question. Does evil mean that God does not exist? So let's first read his objection. It seems that God does not exist, because if one of two contraries be infinite, the other would be altogether destroyed. But the word God means that he is infinite goodness. If, therefore, God existed, there would be no evil discoverable. But there is evil in the world. Therefore, God does not exist. And his reply is straightforward, citing Augustine. He says, since God is the highest good, he would not allow any evil to exist in his works unless his omnipotence and goodness were such as to bring good even out of evil. This is part of the infinite goodness of God, that he should allow evil to exist and out of it produce good. Thomas Aquinas' view is that we can demonstrate that God exists despite evil. But one of the things that he points out in his approach to doing this and on the questions dealing with God's existence and then his nature that he brings up is he points out the fact that we cannot know what God is. And this might sound very radical and something that you perhaps don't hear a lot in your theology type classes, but it's essential to understanding Aquinas's approach. Because we have not seen God face to face, we don't know what he is. In fact, he says in the Summa Theologica, we cannot know what God is. We can only know what he is not. And the reason he says that we can only know what he is not is because we only know God through his effects or through creation. So we have to turn there and start with that. That's our starting point. So let's turn to the question of what is there, and by that I mean starting with creation itself. Aquinas would say that things that exist, or beings, all that has being or esse is a creature. All of our knowledge derives, according to Aquinas, from our sensory contact with things. Aquinas's term for living things is a substance. A substance is a knowable individual in the world. It means that which is possessed of an essence, such that it will exist of itself, even though to exist is not its essence. So something that is living exists of itself, but it cannot account or be the ultimate cause of its existence. Its efficient causation or its agent cause must come from another. That, of course, for Aquinas is God. A cat, for example, is a naturally occurring unit, an entity, an ens in its own right or substance. It subsists in the world, it has its own identity in the natural world. Aquinas tells us that substances are composed of two principles, form and matter. Let's first take a look at form. Form, according to Aquinas, is what something is. It's what something is actually by its nature. And there are two aspects of this. The first is substantial form, that is, what it is, for example, its catness, and also its accidental forms, that is, what it has, that is, it's a certain size, it's a certain color. These are things that it could be otherwise, or things that it could lose, but losing these things or changing these things does not affect in any way its essence or what it is, that is, its substantial form. Form, again, is what something actually is by nature. Accidents or accidental forms are features that are had by the substance that should not enter into an account of what they are by nature. Features can be acquired, or accidents can be acquired and lost, but it doesn't affect what something is. And this, of course, is combined with matter. Now, Aquinas's use of the term matter is not in the scientific sense. He's speaking much more in metaphysical terms here. Matter for him is what individuates a thing. In other words, the form would tell us that it's a cat or a dog, but its matter would individuate it as this cat, as opposed to that cat over there. And this is a principle in being or in the thing, the principle that individuates it. In other words, it arranges the matter. The principle is the arrangement of the matter that distinguishes this cat from that cat. You can have two cats, and you can tell them apart because of their matter. You don't tell them apart because of their form, because the form is what they have in common. They're both cats, but the matter is what individuates it, and that's the arrangement that individuates it to be this cat versus that cat. Another very important principle to explain Aquinas's understanding of what there is the notion of cause or causa. He takes his four causes from Aristotle, and perhaps it's better to use the term explanation. We have a very distinct idea in our mind with regards to cause and effect. Aquinas has a very robust understanding of cause or explanation in terms of identifying various things that makes something what it is or causes something to be in the natural world. And so it's worth looking at these. The first one is the agent cause. And the agent cause, and sometimes this is referred to as the efficient cause, is that by which something comes to be. It's that which actualizes a potential. It brings it into being. Obviously, the cat can't bring itself into being, but what does bring it into being or into existence is the agent cause. Now, for Aquinas, of course, this is God. So God is involved in the explanation of the cat coming to be. The second one is the material cause, that out of which something comes to be. This is the underlying stuff. This is in the scientific term for matter could be used here, that something is made out of. So all that the cat is made out of is in term of its material cause, in the sense of matter, and that matter being what science studies. And then there's the formal cause. The formal cause is to account for its essence, its structure. And this, of course, is governed by the form of what something is, or the essence of what something is. Then, of course, and most important, is the notion of a final cause, that for which something comes to be, the goal, the end purpose of a thing. And in Aquinas' thinking, all of these causes that can be identified can be applied to everything individually in the world, whether it's a natural kind in the world or whether it's a human-made artifact in the world. Everything can be described in terms of these four causes. And they can also be applied generally with respect to the entire world. That is, you can speak of in terms of everything is directed towards an end or directedness. And everything is tended towards an end, whether it knows it or not. The cat may not know about its end. Some people probably don't even know about its directedness or its end or its goal. So whether they're cognizant of it or not doesn't really matter. But they are directed towards an end. Of course, this end completes the loop. The agent cause actualizes the potential, brings it into being, and also directs it towards its end, which of course, God Himself. So these are the terms that Aquinas would use with respect to explaining what there is or creation itself. Now we turned our attention to answering the question, what is good and bad? Good in Aquinas' thinking is an attributive adjective of that which is desirable. And this is important to distinguish because it's not just a moral distinction with regards to his understanding of good. In fact, in Aquinas' thinking, goodness and being are really equivalent terms. Now, they're not synonymous terms, but they are equivalent terms. Something is good insofar as it possesses what is desirable, that is, what it's considered as what it is by nature. And good for Aquinas is not the same thing as perfection. Perfection for Aquinas would lack nothing. For example, you could have a healthy cat and you could call it a perfect cat. But for Aquinas, a sick cat would not be a perfect cat, but it would still be a good cat. So you could still have good attributed to even a sick cat. Because again, in his understanding, something is obviously good in as much as it is being. So what is badness in his thinking? Well, badness for Aquinas has no actual existence. It has no esse. It's not a thing. It's not a substance. So therefore, it does not have a substantial or even an accidental form. There are no substantial forms with regards to badness, and there's no accidental forms with regards to badness. For him, badness is the absence of anything actually existing that should, of course, exist. Badness is a lack of being, but it's a lack of a certain being or a certain good. For example, blindness in a person is bad or evil because sight should be there. People should be able to see, and when they don't see, there's a lack or a badness. But not every absence of a good is necessarily bad. For example, if there's no one in my house right now, that's not really or necessarily a bad thing. And also, a rock not having sight is not a bad thing because it's not of the nature of rocks to see. And it's also worth pointing out that evil or badness could be the presence of a real thing that just is in the wrong place or shouldn't be there. In fact, Davies gives the horrifying example of injecting a living person with embalming fluid in order to illustrate this. The embalming fluid shouldn't be in a living person, and therefore that's bad or that's evil. In Aquinas' understanding, every privation, is found in a subject that is a being, that is an essence, an ends. And in some way, all evil is found in some good. In other words, you can't have evil subsisting in and of itself apart from something that is, in his view, good. If you didn't have good or being, you could not possibly have evil. Evil is always associated again with something that is lacking in good or being. Now we move on to God's nature. For Aquinas, God's existence can be accepted by faith or through demonstration. That is, to accept God's existence on the authority of another, or to accept God's existence by seeing and understanding a philosophical demonstration. Aquinas says, there is nothing to stop people from accepting on faith some demonstrable truth that they cannot personally demonstrate. For in Aquinas' understanding, many or most will probably never see a demonstration of God's existence philosophically, figure it out for themselves, or even be taught it. So most people, in fact, do accept God on the basis of faith. And for Aquinas, that's a perfectly good and legitimate way to believe in the existence of God. But it's also worth pointing out that for Aquinas, God's existence is not an analytical truth. That is, it's not in the mind alone. It's not in the thinking alone. It's not like thinking about triangles, for example, that all triangles have three sides. And the reason for this is that God, in Aquinas' view, is not self-evident. We do not know the essence of God directly, and therefore God is not self-evident to us, because God is not an item in the physical universe. He's not a natural kind that's found in the physical universe. Any knowledge that we have of God must be derived from His effects. That is, what God has caused through his agent causation, brought about, that's how we know about God. In this sense, our knowledge of him is inferential, and it's primarily based on the distinction that we find in creation between essence and existence. God's nature is such that it wills or delights in himself, since he alone is good without reservation. God does not have to create, since creatures contribute nothing to his happiness or his well-being. God is completely self-sufficient. He does not need man. He does not want or lack something that man fulfills for him. Creatures cannot modify God in any way, and everything that creatures are and do is always something that is caused by God. The simplicity of God is extremely important to understanding Aquinas' view of God. Remember that we cannot know what God is. We only know what he is not. And the reason why we must affirm that God is simple is because everything that we see or know in the world is not simple. It's composed. It's composed of form and matter, or actuality and potentiality. And therefore, since God is not a natural kind, or a thing, or a substance that's found in the world, he must be completely different or not composed than that which is found in the world. So that's how he arrives at simplicity. And it's a negative theology. It's saying what God is not. When we say that God is simple, we mean that he's not a natural kind that's found in the world. He's not a cat. He's not a dog. He's not an angel. He is completely simple. Everything that is created is composed of act and potency, or at least is found in the natural world, is a natural kind that is composed of form and matter. But God is not composed of form and matter. God is not actuality and potentiality. God is simple. And so there are at least three things to explore with regards to the notion of simplicity. One is that God is not changeable. This is his immutability. Real change only takes place with regards to that which is found in the created order or the created universe. God cannot go under any substantial change or any accidental change. Of course, he has no accidents. So nothing about God whatsoever can change. Change is only what is possible for that which is in the created world or created universe. Second, God is not an individual belonging to a natural kind. If we could go back to our example of a cat. Cat A is different from cat B, not because of their essence or nature, not because of their catness or their feline nature, but again because of their material distinctness, their numerical difference in terms of their matter, the individuation of their matter. Matter, again, if you remember, is what individuates a thing. This is how we distinguish things in the universe. God is not one of these objects that's found in the universe. God isn't a form-matter composition. He's not a natural kind that can be distinguished in the universe. And the third thing simplicity implies is that God is not created. Everything we find in the universe is composed of essence and existence, and the essence is different from its existence. But God's existence or God's nature can't be distinguished from his existence or esse. And this makes him a necessary being. That is, he cannot not be, or he must be. His existence cannot be thought of as having derived from anything. No one could give him his existence. Now, this doesn't mean that his existence is caused by himself, but what it does mean is that God is not caused by anything. He is uncaused. This is important because this notion of simplicity and these three things that we've drawn out from simplicity make a radical, a very, very radical distinction between the creator and creatures. And this is not often appreciated by those who deal with the problem of evil. And we'll draw out some of the implications related to this when we look into the goodness or perfections of God next. Now we come to God's perfections or goodness. When we use the term that God is good, we need to understand that we are not ascribing a property to God. Some modern theologians or philosophers would look at good or goodness as a property being attributed or ascribed to God, very much the same way that we would ascribe good to something that is found in the natural world. But in Aquinas's view, that's not what's going on here with respect to God. The problem with saying that God is a property or has a property is to make a distinction between what the property is and what the individual is. And according to Aquinas, this is treating God as if he's, again, a natural kind found in the universe, in which his essence is different than his existence. Aquinas denies that there are any distinctions in God. Remember, he's absolutely simple, unlike anything found in the created world. So for him, he denies any distinction between the individual and its nature with respect to God. Now, we may find it very difficult to talk about God. In other words, we must understand that our talk or our language that we use about God is not purely univocal, that is entirely the same, or equivocal, that is entirely different, but our talk about God must be analogical. God's goodness, ultimately, and God himself cannot be distinguishable. God's goodness and God himself cannot be distinguishable, or we can put it this way, whatever God is, he cannot be thought of as subject to improvement or progressing in any way. If we could return to the notion of causation and everything having a final cause or a final end in God, we learn about the nature of the agent from its effects. God accounts for all of the perfections that they have and aim for, and that these reflect him as their maker. Perfections can be found in creatures, but they exist in God in a non-creaturely way. So we cannot think of goodness with respect to God in the same way that we apply it to creatures. We must understand that when it's applied to God, it must be analogically applied to him. Moral goodness, as it is ascribed to humans, is a way of acting, or we would say a habit or habitus. Or it's a virtue because of a moral obligation. Obligations derive from laws, and obligations are binding on humans because there is a human legislator, someone giving the law. But this is only the case for human beings. God, we must understand, is not bound by any human legislator or any legislator. He's not bound by any obligations. There is no law to which God should or does conform. And if we attempt to do such a thing, again, we put God into the category of a natural kind or a creature that is found in the world, and we lapse into an anthropomorphism in terms of talking about God. So moral goodness is not something that we can use to describe God in any way. It's not applicable to God in any way. The wrong view that one might hold is that humans and God are obligated to act a certain way, to act thus and so, and therefore they both have moral obligations. The correct view is to understand that only human beings have moral obligations. God is not bound to any obligation. There is no law to which God should or does conform. If we say, for example, that God is just, there are two ways or two kinds of justice we might be speaking of. There's a communicative type of justice in which there is a mutual giving and receiving. For example, if I purchase something to you, then I have to pay you what you are owed. Well, this is not the kind of justice with respect to God. God doesn't belong to or is obligated by any type of justice that this is communicating. The second kind is a distributive type of justice, by which a ruler distributes to each on the basis of merit. This is, for example, what a parent would provide for a child. Such justice is provided because of some law or directive that is given from a superior. We have to understand that God doesn't fall into either of these types of justices that we run into every single day. God is a law unto himself, and the entirety of creation is ordered in such a way, things are ordered to God in such a way that they befit themselves and they befit him. It is right for God to order the parts of creation to other parts, and God, of course, can bring this about. Let me give an example. The law against, or the order against, humans murdering one another. In other words, it's morally wrong to kill an innocent person, that is, murder. But you have to understand that God is not bound by that law, since he is the cause of life itself, brings being into existence, and orders and directs being that is in existence towards an end, namely himself. God is not bound by our law with regards to murdering. To say that God can never take the life of an innocent person is to assume that he is obligated to law outside himself. And actually, he's not taking it completely out of existence. He's the one that brings it into the world, and he's the one that takes it out of the world. And when it's out of the world, it still is something that is existing. God is the agent causation, and he is the end of that person as well. And so the fact that he causes and orders such things to come into the world and to be taken out of the world puts him completely outside of the category of needing to be governed by a law, such as humans murdering one another is morally wrong. For humans, it's wrong. But God, of course, is not in that category because he alone is in the position of bringing into existence and taking out of existence that which is, and ordering it the way he wants to order it, according to his nature and will. Now we come to the creator and evil. Now we turn our attention to the creator and evil. God wills to create only good, but we need to understand that God's will is not like our will, human free will, is changeable and temporal. It involves reflection and desires. But this is not what we mean exactly by God's will, since God's will, God's free will, is unchangeable and eternal. There's nothing in or outside of God that influences or forces him in any way. God is free to create, since nothing in his nature or acting on him forces him to do so. God only creates what is good and cannot cause evil directly. Even in creating good, he does not have to tolerate evil, although, as Aquinas tells us, he may have to permit evil as a means to an end that is a good end. And God can create anything that is not impossible, that is, anything that does not involve a logical contradiction. But God is causally constrained, and to kind of flesh out what we mean by this, we have to look at what Aquinas says with regards to two types of evil he finds in the world. First, we'll look at evil suffered, and then we'll look at evil done. Those are his terms for natural evil and for evil involving choices or moral decisions made by humans. But first, let's look at evil suffered. Evil suffered has to do with instances of badness that are not directly willed by people. In other words, if God creates a world that is interactive and dependent, such as our world, which is synergistic, that is, that's interdependent, there are going to be constraints and limitations, Aquinas would say. In other words, to give some specific examples, if God creates eating animals, then some will get eaten. If God creates plants that are dependent on water, then a lack of water will wilt the plant. Those are the causal constraints that God is operating with respect to a world such as ours. So is God responsible for evil suffered? Not really, since it is a byproduct of the good that God is causing. God causes only what is good, that is, the esse, the thing that exists. For example, a sick human or a sick person is still, in his view, if you remember, good. And the virus that exists that God created, in his view as well, is good too. Remember, good does not have to be perfect in Aquinas' understanding. The virus works and does what it does in terms of being good, and the sick human, even though the sick human is not perfect, is still good, does what it does in terms of being sick. The evil here does not have an esse or a substance, or a positive attribute or even accident. The evil that is suffered here, the sickness in the person, is a lack or a privation in the good. And God is not directly, again, responsible for that, since it is a byproduct of two essentially good things that have to interact together. It is important to point out that in Aquinas' view, the sickness is not an illusion. It has a kind of existence we might speak of, that is, it has a relational subsistence between essentially good beings or esse, but it doesn't have a substance in and of itself. It doesn't have attribute or accident. It exists only insofar as essentially good things do what they were created to do by God. Hence, God is not the cause of evil suffered. It again is a byproduct of the good that God is causing to exist. To give you a quote from Brian Davies, God can make a world that contains no evil suffered. But God cannot make a material world such as ours without material agents interacting and causing damage to one another. And it is worth in pointing out that all evil suffered ultimately has a concomitant good or end that is in view. And God, as Aquinas says, works that end to bringing out the most possible good achievable. All evil suffered has a concomitant good that's involved, as Aquinas says, that God has a purpose for it in terms of bringing a greater good out of it. The second kind of evil that exists is evil done, Aquinas calls this. This is moral evil. These are instances of badness that are directly willed by people. But in Aquinas's view, there is still goodness with regards to such choices. There's an existing human being that's acting. But of course, there's a lack of goodness with no concomitant good to explain or account for it. And we have to ask, is God responsible for this? And the answer is no, since it is not a created thing. Although God ensures the free existence of something, of someone, or something that is acting badly, again, God is not responsible for it. And the reason is evil and evil done is not a created thing. Although all that is real and occurrences of evil done is caused creatively by God, God does not cause sin. He does cause the existence of the sinner and their sinful acts. But evil done is the gap between what should exist and does not exist. God causes the existence of someone acting badly, yes, but God is not causing the evil done. Aquinas says at one point in the Summa Theologica, can evil done or sin can be called a being and an action only in the sense that something is missing. And this missing element comes from a created cause, that is, the free will in its departure from the order to the first agent who is God. Accordingly, this defect is not ascribed to God as its cause, but to the free will. While we can say that God causes these actions that we do freely choose, He does not choose those actions for us. Hence, God is not responsible for evil done. So let me try to summarize what we've covered here. A material world exists in which some things flourish at the expense of others, and people do not choose well. God's causation does not threaten our freedom, rather, it enables it. We are free not in spite of God, but because of Him. So God does not make Adam sin, but God makes the sinning Adam, the person who is able not to sin, but does sin. So let me wrap this up with some further observations and applications of some of the things that we've pointed out here. First of all, we need to understand that Aquinas never really gives us an explanation of God and evil. We haven't really laid that out here, and it's really not possible to come up with such an explanation. An explanation is something that we understand better than what we invoke it to explain. And Aquinas never even comes close to suggesting that we understand God. Remember, we don't know God directly, and so we don't know God better than anything else. So we can't really come up with an explanation for God and evil. Some have suggested, particularly modern philosophers, that horrendous evil is a challenge to belief in God. But I think it's important to understand that if one evil does not make the case against God, why does much evil do any better? And I don't mean to downplay anything that we would put in the category of horrendous evil in any way. But at least from a standpoint of a theological understanding, but if one evil situation or relationship doesn't make the case against God, why does much evil do any better? So I don't think invoking the notion of horrendous evil really challenges the belief in God, and I don't think Aquinas would either. In Aquinas's view, God is impassible and immutable. That means God does not have passions and He does not change in any way. And I think this is an important point. There are many today, particularly even evangelical theologians, who are compromising these two notions that are found in Aquinas's view of God. And I think it's worth pointing out that these two aspects of God, or understanding of God, which makes Him separate from creation, really makes Him more able to be involved and able to comfort us in our sorrow than if He was not. In other words, if God has to change with respect to His feelings or His passions, That is, God has to feel sorry for us or feel sorrow for us and go from a state of not feeling sorry for us to a state of feeling sorry for us in order for us to be comforted as we would comfort one another. Then we have just put God into a category of being a natural kind of one found in the world, and he's not the ultimate cause or God. Impassibility is worth preserving because it means that God is without changing passions and feelings. God is present to everything. He is not outside or apart from us, but he is in us and all that we are and do. God is making us to be ourselves. God is not someone who is static or indifferent or callous to us. God is actively present and freely at work throughout the created world and order. And although God is immutable, he is the most active being there is. He is the most agile and active being because he again is the agent or the efficient cause of everything that exists and everything that moves. And so God is nearer to us than one of us can be to another. God is closer to us than anyone else can be. And God can be more of a comfort to us because of his stability and immutability and impassibility than anyone else can be to us that is feeling and changing and moving. Because God is immovable and impassible, he is the most comforting being. And I think it's also worth pointing out that this view of God that's presented by Aquinas is compatible with the Bible or with the scriptures. It's definitely compatible with the Old and the New Testament. There we find out in scripture that God is love. But God's love for creatures is not something that is emotionally affected or emotionally changeable. Love in terms of emotions or feelings is not something that is ascribed to God. Emotions or feelings are what humans undergo as they're affected or moved by objects in the physical world or in our environment. God loves all creatures, and his love is the same as willing goodness. And as we pointed out earlier, moral justification is not a category that applies to God. And the Bible never offers or suggests the need for God to be morally justified. And of course, this follows since he's not a natural kind in the created world, as we pointed out. And this, of course, is why we can find some verses, such as that found in Deuteronomy, where he says in chapter 7, verses 1 through 2, "Only in the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them." God alone is able to give such a command because God brings, as I mentioned before, into existence being, and he can take that out of the world, not ceasing it to exist, but holding it still in existence, just not in the world anymore. While you and I, of course, need to be morally justified and need to obey the rules and the laws that are laid down, God does not. The Bible, again, nowhere tries to morally justify God in his orders and his commands, because again, he's not the category does not apply to him. God is not something that's found in the natural world that is subject to moral laws and obligations. Not too long ago, I was given the opportunity to speak on this topic in the context of a church Sunday school class. And I hadn't read very much on it and found that a few recent books had been written on it. One by the title of Is God a Moral Monster? Another one, God Behaving Badly. As I read through these books, while they certainly allowed for the view that I'm giving you here, they, for the most part, tried to persuasively send the reader in a completely different direction in making God into someone who was politically justifiable in what he did. And while certainly I appreciate the background, the historical background, and some of the textual observations, I found in the end that they had a not so robust view of God. They had done no discussion on the classical view of God, or for that matter, other views of God, and had very little bearing on what they had to say. Most of their justification for God, most of their book, assumed the need to justify God and to do so by looking at the textual background and history with respect to specific instances. They failed to really recognize a correct or classical view of the very nature of God. And finally, God solves the human problem of evil. And he does this via the beatific vision. The beatific vision is the beatitude of happiness. All happiness derives from God, and all of creation and man strives towards an end, which is this happiness. It's the ultimate fulfillment of all human desires. And God brings this about in some people who, of course, believe in him and receive his Son, Jesus Christ, as their personal Savior. And, of course, he quarantines others from this experience in order to prevent evil from existing with them again. Of course, this is a state of happiness exceeding any other achievable before death.